Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 524, titled The Safari Club and the Islamic Bomb. This is being recorded on August 28th of the year 2005. We're once again going to be accessing information from a very important new book about the intelligence community. This book gets the Dave Emery five-star rating, so to speak, and I can't encourage listeners strongly enough to go out and get a hold of it. By the way, I don't get any money from this. The book is called Prelude to Terror, authored by Joseph J. Trento. It's just out in hardcover, copyrighted by Joseph Trento, but published by Carolyn Graff. We talked about the Safari Club in For the Record 522. Going to review very quickly a couple of aspects of what the Safari Club is, because what we're going to be taking a look at is how the Safari Club, basically an outsourcing of key U.S. intelligence functions to a privatized network financed by, in large measure, and conducted in conjunction with not only Saudi intelligence but Pakistani intelligence, how this led directly to the formation of the Islamic bomb. In the run-up to the Iraq War in the early 2 years of 2000 of this century, we were told by Condi Rice that we had to make sure that we did this so there wouldn't be a mushroom cloud. The smoking gun shouldn't be a mushroom cloud. Well, one of the things that Condi Rice did not tell us, not surprisingly, was that the Islamic bomb, the Islamic nuclear capability, which may ultimately come back to haunt us in a devastating way, was a direct outgrowth of intelligence policies pursued by the current seated president's father and Ronald Reagan and the intelligence milieu of which they were a part. During the closing years of the Carter administration, they were complicit with this as well. But the fact of the matter is that the mushroom cloud that may at some point form over an American city, courtesy of Islamic nuclear terror, is a direct outgrowth of the policies of both Georges Bush and of the Safari Club. Now, reviewing very quickly what the Safari Club is, first of all, we're going to read from the introduction to Prelude to Terror. This material was in For the Record 522, but I'm presenting it here by way of review for the listeners who have not review, and for also by way of introduction for listeners who were not tuned in to For the Record 522. Prelude to Terror will focus on how the privatization of intelligence metamorphosed from an instrument of limited application in the 1950s into a broad-based core operating model of significant proportions in the 1970s and 80s. Simultaneously, a secret alliance was forged with Saudi intelligence. This alliance was orchestrated by CIA covert management without the knowledge of Congress and, in some cases, even the president. Ultimately, as these two developments became increasingly intertwined, a dynamic of catastrophic proportions was created, one that left the United States with a severely compromised intelligence apparatus in the Middle East. By the way, I would note here that the relationship here that we're seeing in the intelligence community is directly reflective of and an outgrowth of economic relationships which cemented not only the Bush family but also elements of the Texas and right-wing Republican power elite with the Saudis, reactionary views on a number of things, and the all business, as they call it in Texas, being the cementing elements. Now, what the Safari Club is described by Joe Trento. The Prince Turki here and Sheikh Kamal Adem were two chiefs of Saudi intelligence. Prince Turki was the fellow who ran Osama bin Laden throughout the 80s and most of the 90s. Prince Turki resigned from his position as Saudi intelligence chief after more than two decades, about a week and a half before September 11th took place. Prince Turki, the main fellow in the Saudi end of the Safari Club, is now the Saudi ambassador to the United States. Isn't that special? Of the Safari Club, Joe Trento writes, both Prince Turki and Sheikh Kamal Adam would play enormous roles in servicing a spy network designed to replace the official CIA while it was under congressional scrutiny between the time of Watergate and at the end of the Carter administration. The idea of using the Saudi royal family to bypass the American Constitution did not originate in the kingdom. Adam was initially approached by one of the most respected and powerful men in Washington, Clark Clifford, who rose to power under Harry Truman and had enjoyed a relationship with the intelligence community for years. Quote, Clark Clifford approached Kamal Adam and asked that the Saudis consider setting up an informal intelligence network outside the United States during the investigations, Robert Crowley said. Crowley, in his role as the CIA's liaison to the corporate world, was privy to the plan, in which worldwide covert operations for the agency were funded through a host of Saudi banking and charity enterprises. Several top U.S. military and intelligence officials directed these operations from positions they held overseas, notably former CIA Director Richard Helms, at this time ambassador to Iran. Ed Wilson and his associates supported the network. According to Wilson, Prince Turki was used to finance several of his intelligence operations during this time period. According to Wilson, the amounts were in the millions of dollars. According to Tom Clines, the relationship between the Saudis and the private U.S. intelligence network that grew out of the activities of Clines and his colleagues was, quote, vital. These operations were so sensitive they could not be revealed, unquote. Mike Pilgrim, who also played a role in the operations of the private network during the 1980s, said, quote, it got to the point where we were used to support GID, parenthetically Saudi intelligence operations, when the CIA could not. According to those involved, there was no line drawn between what was official and what became personal business. Now, this network was formed when the elder George Bush was director of the CIA. It was the main intelligence element involved with the Iraqgate and Iran-Contra machinations, and also the support for the Afghan Mujahideen. And as we've seen in many past broadcasts, the elder George Bush, when he was president of the vice president of the United States, presided over those covert operations through his own private intelligence network that grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. As we've seen, one of the things that grew out of the Safari Club was the Saudi ability to spy on the United States. Skipping down again and speaking of Prince Turki, Turki's secret was that the Saudi royal family had taken over intelligence funding for the United States. It was during this period that the Saudis opened up a series of covert accounts at Riggs Bank in Washington. Starting in the mid-70s, bank investigators say these accounts show that tens of millions of dollars were being transferred between CIA operational accounts and accounts controlled by Saudi companies and the Saudi embassy itself. And it's made very clear that one of the things the Saudis were interested in doing and did do was to spy on U.S. intelligence. This network was the primary element involved in the Afghan Mujahideen support effort, again, at the direction of the elder George Bush. And ultimately, the compromising of U.S. intelligence by this network could not be exaggerated. The transfer of technology that we're about to see, the ultimate compromising of the United States with regard to nuclear matters, was anticipated by a stunning transfer of keyword software technology that had been developed by the National Security Agency. Speaking of the damage done by the Safari Club and the outsourcing of U.S. intelligence to a large extent to Saudi Arabia, to make matters worse, the CIA official continued, the CIA permitted U.S. Customs at Dulles Airport to overlook an illegal export of our most secret eavesdropping software to Saudi Arabia, unquote. The software, referred to as Keyword Software, is a computer code developed for the National Security Agency by a company called eSystems. The software allows keywords and phrases to be flagged by computers from targeted voice and other communications in real time. The problem with exporting the software is that any country getting it could use it to target U.S. interests and allies. It could even be used to track what U.S. law enforcement, military, and intelligence agencies were doing. Parenthetically, consider the implications of this for some of the things that went wrong on September 11th, bearing in mind that large elements of Saudi intelligence were sympathetic to Osama bin Laden. Louis Sams, the man eSystems ordered to deliver the software to the kingdom, said, I was very nervous when I got to the airport. I knew it was illegal to take it out of the country, but I was given the name of a customs official at Dulles Airport and told if there were any problems to ask for him. eSystems' desire to do business with the royal family was why I thought they sent me, unquote. Sam said that eSystems, which had close ties to the White House, maintained the secret communications gear for Air Force One. As it turned out, eSystems did not get the contract for Saudi intelligence, but the software was left with GID officials, even so, according to SAMS. And that stunning technology transfer, basically, by what I have referred to so many times as a fifth column actively subverting the United States, that transfer pales beside the transfer of nuclear technology, which was part of an outgrowth of the Safari Club, and in particular was a quid pro quo engaged in by the Safari Club related of U.S. intelligence and the Reagan and Bush administrations for the Saudi and Pakistani participation against the Soviets in the Afghan war and the Saudi and ISI Pakistani intelligence support for the Mujahideen. So again, as we contemplate a grim future and as we look back in anger, as well we should, at Condi Rice's warnings about a mushroom cloud, hopefully the smoking gun won't be a mushroom cloud, said the redoubtable Ms. Rice. Well, just bear in mind when that happens, which it probably will at some point, just remember where that technology came from and who presided over its transfer. We're now going to take a look at the Safari Club and the Kleins, Shackley, Ed Wilson Network's participation in the Afghan Mujahideen support effort. Bear in mind, at this point, Ed Wilson had been shoved out of the operation, but that network was very much in place. It was involved with the Iran-Contra affair and with the Afghan Mujahideen support effort. Of the Safari Club and the development of the Islamic bomb, we read, once again, from Joseph J. Trento's excellent Prelude to Terror, "The same leadership that promulgated the Safari Club, the Saudi royals, also strongly funded and supported the Islamic Development Bank. Begun in 1973, the IDB now has 55 member states, with Saudi Arabia dominating, with 27.33% of the bank's funding. As a comparison, Egypt contributes only 9.48% and Pakistan just 3.41% of the bank's total capital. It was through the bank's scientific and economic development efforts that huge amounts were funneled into Pakistan, which ended up in the hands of A.Q. Khan and his now infamous nuclear bomb-building syndicate." There's been a lot written about the A.Q. Khan network. The A.Q. Khan network developed out of the machinations of the Safari Club. Continuing, "The effort that began prior to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and that President Carter's National Security Advisor warned was a serious effort to build the first Islamic bomb was deliberately ignored by Carter in order to secure Saudi and Pakistani cooperation for the anti-Soviet effort in Afghanistan. Like almost everything about the anti-Soviet effort, the Reagan administration expanded on it, and the CIA directly assisted the Pakistani nuclear effort by allowing Pakistani nationals to procure hardware for the program in violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty." By the way, toward the end of this passage on the other side, we're going to take a look at a network run by a fellow named Nazir Ahmed Vaid, who appears to was certainly involved with the A.Q. Khan network, may very well have been a CIA and U.S. intelligence asset of some sort attached to the Safari Club, but he was gallivanting back and forth into the United States after September 11th, and in among other programs for the record 500, we've taken a look at very concrete indications that elements of Pakistani intelligence actively supported September 11th. Continuing, quote, "There was nothing more important than propping up a free Afghanistan. One of the things I did was to try to get the Afghan king, then living in exile in Italy, to come back to Afghanistan so we could build a new government," Thomas Kleins recalled. Although he was out of the CIA and now officially retired, quote, "I was trying to do my part in keeping Afghanistan in our column. Shackley was working with the royal families in the Gulf. All were contributing to the effort in the early 1980s, unquote. Kleins conceded that the off-the-books intelligence operations had been melded into the Afghan war effort. Quote, "We worked for who was helping the United States the most. The Saudis worked very closely with us," unquote. Kleins recalled how Bernard Houghton, who had run Nugan Hand Bank in Saudi Arabia until it ran out of money, played a key role working with Prince Turkey and the Saudi GID. Again, GID, Saudi intelligence, Prince Turkey, the chief of same, Prince Turkey, the man who ran Osama bin Laden. Continuing, "What many people do not know was that the Safari Club had made a deal with Pakistan at the expense of the Afghan people. The Safari Club was run by the Saudis. It was a club to serve their purposes through the CIA. Shackley and Wilson were not members, only nations could belong. Shackley and Wilson were men who served the club in exchange for power, influence, and money. Pakistani intelligence would handle all the money going to facilitate the proxy war against the Soviets. That meant that hundreds of millions of dollars from the United States and Saudi Arabia were being run through Pakistan with no accountability. Unfortunately, unquote, said Robert Crowley, again quoting, the Pakistanis knew exactly where their cut of the money was to go, unquote. Where the money went was into an Islamic nuclear weapons program supported by Saudi Arabia and accepted by the United States. During the early 1990s, British Customs began looking closely at the United States-Pakistani nuclear network. One of their top agents was an Arabic-speaking Muslim who traveled the world tracking down AQ Khan's network. The British soon learned that the United States had no interest in shutting down the network, which had been operating for years. Parenthetically, we're talking here about the early 1990s. The Soviet Union doesn't even exist at this point, so keep that in mind. The British soon learned that the United States had no interest in shutting down the network, which had been operating for years. The Muslim customs agent, whose identity must be protected for his own safety, was actually confronted by Khan in Dubai, where the agent had traced a number of Khan's front companies. The agent testified in a trial involving associates of Khan's that the father of the Pakistani bomb confronted the Muslim customs agent and called him, quote, a traitor to the Muslim people, unquote, for uncovering the nuclear network that was supplying weapons equipment to Libya, Iran, Malaysia, and North Korea. A top French intelligence official, who asked that his name be withheld from publication, described the U.S.-Pakistani cover-up of the Khan network as having, quote, an important precedent. Just as the U.S. allowed Israel to develop nuclear weapons under pressure from the Saudis, the U.S. allowed Pakistan to be Saudi Arabia's proxy as the first Islamic nuclear state. The Saudis put up the cash and have clean hands as Pakistan builds the bomb for its supposed defense against India over Kashmir, but my country and the British received no cooperation starting in the 1980s when we discovered traces of Khan's network. The U.S. did not want to discuss it, unquote. A senior source in the British government who asks not to be named confirms that Khan ran the network and that parts for the nuclear weapons program came from the United States. Khan's daughter, attending school in England, was being tutored, and at the end of faxes dealing with logistics for her education, Khan would sometimes write, in his own hand, items he needed for the nuclear program. We're going to be talking about the various networks involved in this nuclear program. Note that the BCCI, which we've spoken about so many times, was used for much of the machinations for the AQ Khan network. And as we'll see, that was covered up by the Bush administration, that is the elder George Bush administration. Note that the BCCI's role in helping to develop Pakistan's Islamic bomb, unquote, was revealed by the person who conducted the congressional investigation into the BCCI. That was a fellow by the name of John Kerry. Some people may have heard of him. Continuing, Pakistan's quest for nuclear weapons had begun some 15 years earlier. Shortly after taking office in 1972, Pakistani Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto expressed his determination to develop a nuclear capability. His purpose was twofold: to offset the inherent threat posed by Pakistan's much larger neighbor and avowed enemy India, and to make his country a leader of the Islamic world. After India detonated its first atomic weapon on the Pakistani border in 1974, Bhutto pushed his nuclear program into high gear. To lead the effort, he tapped Abdul Qadir Khan, an accomplished metallurgist and businessman with a strong desire for wealth. To finance his ambitious program, Bhutto turned to his country's oil-rich ally, Saudi Arabia, and to Libya. China also pledged assistance. By 1976, when George Bush served as CIA director, U.S. intelligence estimates reported in a secret CIA report on Pakistan that Pakistan was engaged in, quote, a crash program to develop nuclear weapons, unquote. In 1979, while awaiting execution following his overthrow, Bhutto wrote in his memoirs that his goal as prime minister had been to put the Islamic civilization, unquote, on an even footing with, quote, Christian, Jewish, and Hindu civilizations, unquote, by creating a, quote, full nuclear capability, unquote, for the Islamic world. The man who overthrew Bhutto, General Muhammad Zia-ul-Haq, carried on that effort. In April of 1979, when President Zia refused to halt work on the Islamic bomb, President Jimmy Carter cut off American economic and military aid to Pakistan. Just 8 months later, however, following the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan, Carter struck the ultimate Faustian bargain in order to win Zia's approval for using Pakistan as a base of operations for the Mujahideen. Zia's fortunes further improved following the 1980 election of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. With the covert U.S. war in Afghanistan intensifying, the Pakistani dictator gained significant advantage, and he used it. In addition to winning large economic and military aid packages for his country, he extracted a promise from the Reagan-Bush administration that there would be no U.S. interference in Pakistan's internal affairs, unquote. That meant no complaints about Zia's dictatorial rule and no obstruction of his efforts to build an Islamic bomb. To keep up appearances, Zia publicly maintained that he was not developing nuclear weapons. However, in 1983, a secret State Department briefing memo revealed that there was, quote, unambiguous evidence, unquote, that Pakistan was, quote, actively pursuing a nuclear weapons development program, unquote, and that China was providing technological assistance. At the time, U.S. law prohibited providing assistance to any country that was importing certain nuclear weapons technology. The Reagan-Bush administration simply ignored the legislation, arguing that cutting off aid to Pakistan would harm U.S. national interests. Throughout the 1980s, Congressman Charlie Wilson, the former Ed Wilson associate acting in concert with the CIA, repeatedly blocked congressional efforts to halt American funding of Pakistan in order to protect a key ally in the covert Afghan war. Wilson, by the way, that's Charlie Wilson, a congressman from Texas, Wilson went so far as to tell Zia, quote, Mr. President, as far as I'm concerned, you can make all the bombs you want, unquote. Zia privately assured the congressman that Pakistan's nuclear program was peaceful and that it would never build a delivery system, quote, The truth was the Americans had little choice, Salahuddin said. By the way, I should interject here. Dawood Salahuddin, the former David Belfield, was an African-American Muslim who not only converted to Islam but fell under the sway of Saeed Ramadan of the Muslim Brotherhood. He committed a key assassination of a former Iranian official under the Shah in Washington, D.C., then fled abroad, was given shelter first in Iran. Eventually, Salahuddin did become one of the freedom fighters in Afghanistan, and had a fair amount to reveal subsequently to Joseph J. Trento about some of the clandestine activities that were attendant upon the Afghan Mujahideen support effort. Beginning again, Zia privately assured the congressman that Pakistan's nuclear program was peaceful and that it would never build a delivery system. Quote, The truth was the Americans had little choice, unquote, Salahuddin said. Zia was worshipped by the Mujahideen. He was the only foreign leader who attracted universal admiration amongst them, even though they were well aware that his ISI, inter-service intelligence guys, were taking what the Afghans figured was a 60% cut on all that was being sent to them. None of that took any glow off Zia's halo. He was the only one to open his country to the Afghan resistance, allowed training camps, and there were always more Afghan refugees in Pakistan than in Iran. The Iranians did nothing of the sort or the scale in the military sphere. The guy was almost saint-like for the resistance, unquote. Zia continued to deceive the United States about his nuclear weapons ambitions. In the mid-1980s, he flatly told the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Vernon Walters, that Pakistan was not building a bomb. When senior State Department officials later confronted him about the misrepresentation, Zia told them, quote, It is permissible to lie for Islam, unquote. He eventually gave up the pretense, telling Time magazine in 1987 that, quote, Pakistan has the capability of building the bomb, unquote. And we are going to continue with our story of how the Safari Club and the various individuals and elements attended upon it, including the Reagan and Bush administrations, Prince Turki, who ran Osama bin Laden and was arguably the point man for the Safari Club. We're going to look at the BCCI's role in funding the Islamic bomb. However, we're going to do that inside, too. For the benefit of listeners who only listen on the radio, directed at those listeners, I can't encourage you strongly enough to supplement your listening efforts by going to the internet and accessing a vast array and a growing array of information. In the first place, I turn each For the Record program into a long, article-length, written description featuring the text made available for fair use. This type of broadcasting, the type I've been using for so many years now, is admittedly very, very pedantic, and so if some of this goes by you, that's altogether to be expected, please go to the internet and access the printed descriptions. Even if you're not online yourself, you can go to your local library and get them printed up either for free or for a very, very modest sum, or perhaps rely on some friends who have internet access for that. Note also that an enterprising listener back east has been turning the descriptions, in turn, into a blog. So there's now a For the Record blog sphere as well. The same for the RFA archive programs. Heroic sister station WFMU-FM has been archiving the For the Record programs. The entire For the Record series is available on Real Audio, or in some cases on MP3 as well. You can access the last couple of hundred or so, really more than that, almost about 250-plus shows on Real Audio streaming at www.wfmufm.org/Dave Emery, one word, DaveEmory. And older shows are available for download only on a longer URL. Link to both that and to the For the Record section of the Spitfire website at www.spitfirelist.com. WFMU is now podcasting the For the Record shows, and on the Spitfire website, that is the website of the CD duplication service that stocks all of the work that I've done, there is again a vast array of audio and printed information. In addition to the For the Record descriptions and descriptions of other shows, there are lectures available, two very important lectures about the future. The For the Record series is available for several weeks after I've recorded the programs, and the Spitfire website features the remarkable and suppressed text by Paul Manning, Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, on both PDF and on HTML. There's also a link to a website maintained by listeners in the Midwest that feature the declassified government documents proving the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and most importantly, after World War II. There's a search function on the Spitfire website, and also there is a page to click on to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what you're seeing here, there could be no better way of supporting and fighting against that than supporting, or basically, no better way of fighting against that than supporting the work that I'm doing. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 524, The Safari Club and the Islamic Bomb. This is being recorded on August 28th of the year 2005. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.